If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, and this is the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Welcome to What Doesn't Kill You. I have a great show for you today because those of you who are regular listeners know that a few weeks ago I interviewed Kathleen Merrigan. She was my last show for 2016, and during that show I was rumbling the praises of an organization that I particularly admire called the IPES, the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Foods. And one of their members, one of their North American members, is going to join me today, Molly Anderson from Middlebury College, will be joining me today to talk about food systems and food policy in the United States. But before we go there, we're going to go here. And that's, you know, my usual joys and sorrows thing. And you know, honestly, people, I'm just so freaking despondent over our impending inauguration that I literally do not have a single joy to tell you about. I don't have a joy. And usually I work really hard to get a joy going here. But today, no, I didn't have a joy in my heart. And so I just have some sort of disturbing but interesting news to tell you. So there was a front page report at the Huffington Post, and this was also echoed in the New York Times. A new report on sushi in Los Angeles says that 47% of the fish that was tested is mislabeled. So that made me think about the overall food fraud business in around the world, which I learned when writing my book, What's the Matter with Meat? I learned that food fraud is a $47 billion business globally, that it supports both organized crime and drug dealers, among others, as well as just kind of your average middleman, you know, scumbag who's looking to defraud the population. And so anyway, I looked into fish fraud, which is really a huge problem in the United States and very unfair to local fishermen. And it turns out that there is a marvelous organization called Oceana. I don't know if any of you have looked at their website, but I strongly recommend it, especially if you're a regular fish eater. I myself do not eat fish, so fortunately I am spared the pain of fish fraud. But nevertheless, Oceana is a nonprofit that studies the fish supply. And they found in a most recently, they found results from 200 studies from 55 countries. The U.S. boasts an average seafood fraud rate of 30% of all the fish in this country, which is mislabeled, and 58% of those are fish that could cause health problems from toxins or allergens, for example, escalar, which is frequently substituted for white tuna. But here are some other results from an earlier report, 2010-2012. They collected 1,200 samples in 21 states from 674 retail outlets. And here's the bad news, people. Mislabeling was found in 27 of the 46 fish types tested. That's 59% of all fish. Salmon, snapper, cod, tuna, sole, halibut, and grouper were the top collected fish types. Snapper and tuna, 87% of snapper and 59% of tuna were the most commonly mislabeled fish types. Only 7 of the 120 red snapper samples were honestly labeled. That's kind of amazing, isn't it? This is out of 1,200 samples. Between one-fifth to more than one-third of the halibut, grouper, cod, and Chilean sea bass samples were mislabeled. 44% of all the grocery stores, restaurants, and sushi venues visited sold mislabeled seafood. And 84% of the white tuna samples were actually escalar, a species that can cause serious digestive issues for some individuals who eat more than a few ounces. So basically, It's really just as you want to know your farmer, know your food, you want to know your fisherman. And Obama, in his last few months in office, has been actually over the last year has been working to try to rectify that by creating a better system of traceability from fishing boat to table. And that is all still sort of pending legislation. I think given the givens, we can imagine that that effort will be languishing over the next 4 years. And we're hoping that it's no more than that. And then yesterday, the other thing that really struck me was the Times had a long piece on our incoming director of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, a man who has made a career of fighting the EPA on behalf of large corporations who seek to pollute with impunity. And today, the Times features our incoming Secretary of Labor, Andrew Puster, who has spent his career fighting improvements in conditions and wages for workers. Meanwhile, ethics investigations are being sidelined. All of these dirtbags that are being selected for the cabinet are being fast-tracked. What is wrong with the government? What's wrong with the Democrats? And why is any of this outrageous behavior, including Trump calling diplomatic shots before his inauguration, or his refusal to release any documents pertaining to his taxes or business holdings, his refusal to divest himself of his business, why are we helpless in the face of this behavior? I don't understand. So if you have the answer, please write to me on my show page or Twitter feed, at K Corrigan K. That's K-C-O-R-R-I-G-A-N-K, like wrong way Corrigan, only it's K Corrigan K. So, I mean, I don't understand where our legislators are in letting this go forward. I am baffled. Facebook is full of, you know, numbers to call and people to see and things to do. I don't know. I mean, I'm going to D.C. for the Women's March. I expect to see all of you there or in your local march. And I am certain I'm going a few days early, and I am certainly going to be spending a day walking around the Senate and the House of Representatives demanding to know why this guy is getting to do whatever he wants with impunity. It just doesn't make sense. Anyway, with that said, we will take a short break, and then we'll be right back with Molly Anderson from Middlebury College. She is going to be talking about the wonderful International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems, IPES Food. So stay tuned. She's her own. She's her own.
New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State Grown and Certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State Grown and Certified seal tells them their food is grown right, right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do. But the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
My guest today is Molly Anderson. She is the William R. Keenan Jr. Professor of Food Studies at Middlebury College in Vermont, where she teaches about food and hunger and food security, fixing food systems and sustainability. She is involved in food system planning at the state and regional scales, participates in the Regional Food Solutions New England Network. I'd like to know more about that. And the National Interinstitutional Network for Food, Agriculture, and Sustainability, as well as being a member of the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems, IPES-Food. She was a coordinating lead author on the International Assessment of Agricultural Knowledge, Science, and Technology for the Development. For development, I'm sorry, Molly, I'm kind of botching this up, and served on the board of the Community Food Security Coalition for 6 years. She has worked as a private consultant for domestic and international organizations with Oxfam America and at Tufts University, where she was the founding director of the Agriculture, Food, and Environment Graduate Program in the School of Nutrition Science and Policy, and she directed the Tufts Institute of the Environment for 2 years. See, the reason I screw up biographies like that is because they just make me feel so bad about my own paltry accomplishments that I just want to sabotage you before you even get on the air, Molly. That's how I am. That's the kind of person I am. Welcome.
Thanks, Katie. And I should say everybody screws up the full name of the ISTAD, the International Assessment. It's such a cumbersome name, and knowledge is in there, but it's not in the acronym for various reasons, maybe because it made it even more cumbersome.
Yes, absolutely. You really can't even say that. I mean, ISTAD, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, welcome to the program, Molly. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I should remind people that once again, which I keep forgetting to announce the name of the show, but this is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. And I am your host, Katie Kiefer, just in case you didn't know that already. Molly, why don't we start by you talking about IPES, because I was yodeling your praises during my interview with Kathleen Merrigan a few weeks ago. I just love your newsletter to death, and I love and admire the people who are, participating in this organization. So give us a thumbnail of what it is, when it started, and how it works.
Well, I'd be glad to do that. It's IPES Food is a group of about 20. The maximum number is 25, but I think we're at 20 right now. Scientists, NGO people, activists, people who are working on food and farming systems from many different perspectives. It includes people who come from different disciplines. For instance, my background is in systems ecology, but there are other people who are political scientists, agronomists, lots of other things. The idea of IPES Food is to bring together a group that could tackle some of the big challenges that are facing us, some of the global challenges in food and agriculture, and do so independently without having to answer to folks who might tell us, oh, no, you can't deal with that because that's a little too politically sensitive. So Olivier Deschutes, who was the special rapporteur on right to food until, 2014, I think, is when he finished his mandate. He started this up. He and Olivia Yambi, who had previously worked with UNICEF, are the co-chairs of the group. We have a secretariat of really fabulous people who help support us. And then the group comes together a couple of times a year face-to-face so that we can talk about not only our agenda of the things that we think are really important to be tackling, but also discuss the products that are in the works and work through the different perspectives that we have on what each one should say, what the recommendation should be. For me, it's really been an incredible opportunity to interact with some of the people who I consider some of the smartest folks working on food and agriculture internationally. After working on the ISTAD, it's a real pleasure to have interaction with Hans Herren again. He was one of the co-directors of the ISTAD along with Judy Wakungu, and then Bob Watson was sort of working above them as directing the entire project. But I have tremendous respect for this group of people and also for the process that we've established, which is intentionally not just interdisciplinary but transdisciplinary. It's reaching beyond academia, reaching into different ways that people see the world and see problems. For instance, the perspective of people coming from social movements, and agroecology is a huge social movement worldwide now. Their perspective is really quite different from the perspective of most academicians, but it's critical that we be looking and understanding how different people approach both problems and solutions.
Absolutely. Well, you guys published just this past year at the end of the year, close to the end of the year, you published, it was in the summer, wasn't it? Your comprehensive report called Uniformity to Diversity. And that's what we're going to be discussing today. And that was like about 60, 70 pages of first laying out, you had three sections, you laid out the problems, you laid out the sort of well, what you call lock-ins, which I thought the psychology aspect of this was very interesting. When you talk about the interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary, I mean, including sort of mindsets and the way people think about problems or think about solutions was such an important part of this process. And then finally, you give some solutions. Can you talk a little bit about some of the main points that, that came out of that paper?
Yeah, let me say first that this was our first technical report from IPES Food, and folks can see it if they go online to ipes-food.org. They can get a copy of the report and read for themselves what it has to say. But the key messages in some ways echoed many of the key messages from the ISTAT, which had been published in 2009.
Wow.
That made a huge splash internationally, although I have to say it was suppressed in the United States and no support really from the U.S. government was given to the ISTAT.
Yeah.
But the messages are that the way that we are feeding ourselves, the way that we are producing food, distributing it, processing it, and then consuming it, the entire food system is bankrupt now. It's basically killing us and killing the planet because the environmental problems that are associated with industrialized food production, processing, distribution, retailing, the whole shebang. The problems are massive,
yes,
and they're only getting worse. So we desperately need an alternative. It's true that that food system has succeeded in producing huge volumes of food and distributing it all around the world. And I'm sure some people who are listening are kind of gasping in shock that I would say it's completely dysfunctional. But we have to have a system that's actually restoring degraded land and providing healthy food and sustainable livelihoods,
mm-hmm,
which is not what we have. But
that's
that
right.
Is the promise of agroecology. We can tweak what we've got now, and that's what has been tried in most ways in industrialized countries. But tweaking is not enough. We really need a fundamentally different model of agriculture that's based on diversified farming systems,
yeah,
farming landscapes, replacing chemical inputs, making sure that we're restoring land, restoring biodiversity, trying to protect the biodiversity that's remaining.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the aim of the report. And what we tried to do with these lock-ins is show why a system that is so dysfunctional, that's broken in so many ways, despite having high yields, why it's persisted.
Yeah.
That's the big question.
It is.
If we've got this great alternative in front of us,
mm-hmm,
why isn't everybody switching over?
Well, that is really the fundamental question. But I wanted to bring up something that I thought was interesting, because your report pointed out that there has been a 3-year decline in income over the past 3 years for American farmers, despite the use of our GMO crops, despite the high-yield grain crops. And I'm just curious, why is that, given that the level of productivity associated with industrial farming practices, not to mention the fact that the fuel prices are unusually low right now and crop insurances, you know, give farmers a real leg up in terms of industrialized farming. Why is there a decline in income? I don't understand.
Well, you don't have to go to the IPES Food Report to discover that. This is very well known, and agricultural economists, people working for the Economic Research Service for USDA will tell you the same thing. It's basically that commodity prices have dropped since 2013.
Uh-huh.
There's been a huge drop in revenue for commodities, especially corn and soy.
Right.
So we've had multiple years. It's basically supply and demand.
Uh-huh.
And it comes back to this overemphasis on productivity that is creating so many problems. We've had multiple years of record or near record corn and soybean harvests. And corn and soybean have historically been about, 25% of farm sector revenue. But farmers are so dependent on those few commodity crops. We don't have a system of supply management in this country.
Right.
We've got constant efforts, constant research to increase productivity, even though basically we've got too much of the stuff.
Right. The glut in the market has depressed the prices, right?
That's exactly it.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, that brings me to my next point. I was setting you up for this. There was a significant section of the report devoted to the concept of export orientation in global farming systems. And I really want you to unpack what that means for people, because I, you know, that is clearly sort of at the root of the problem with the soy and corn glut. The fact that we are gearing so much of our agricultural output towards export, and I don't mean just grains, I mean also like the meat industry, you know, derives a great deal of its income. Just to let you know, I'm about to publish a book about the meat industry, so I'm come up kind of really into that whole, that whole thing of like, where is our meat going? How much of that accounts for farming income in the nation and so forth? So talk a little bit about export orientation and how that has shaped both our farm policy and our food policy.
Okay.
Or lack thereof.
Well, we have been pushing exports, pushing an increased balance of trade so that we're exporting more than we import, which is pretty tough because we're importing so much. But all of this export isn't really helping farmers. It's helping the companies that control export,
right,
the big multinational trading firms, the Bungies, the Cargills, the
Archer Daniels Midland,
right, the different companies that are into this worldwide, buying up wherever they can buy up most cheaply and selling it wherever they can sell it at the best price, which is working very much to the disadvantage, especially of small scale and poor farmers. They're thrown out there on a global market, and they have to compete with farmers, I'm thinking small scale poor farmers from other countries. They
right.
have to compete with farmers who are being subsidized in the EU and the United States, and who have lots of other things going for them. So the latest figures are that only about 23% of food is being traded globally. Most people rely for their food, most people worldwide, on local and national markets. Small-scale farmers are producing 70 to 80% of the food that's being consumed worldwide and selling it mainly in these markets, which are being called more and more territorial markets. And there's a big push to strengthen these local and national markets to help poor farmers, but also a big push in the United States for local food systems because it's much easier for farmers to benefit from a local food system. In the clearest case, where farmers are direct marketing through something like community-supported agriculture or a farmer's market, they can actually set their prices. And, of course, if they set it too high, nobody's going to buy from them. So they have to operate within reasonable limits. But if they are doing good things for the environment, then they can tell their customers about that. If they're treating their labor well, they can tell their customers about that. And people care about these other values beyond just what's your total yield of corn or soy. It matters more and more to the American consumer, but also to people in other countries. But with international trade, we're talking about commodities, which are fungible. They're interchangeable. So if you have something that's been grown using extra special, careful environmental stewardship, then that's not, the farmer is not going to get a better return for that. If they're selling under a certification system, something like organic and for labor fair trade, then they might get a premium. But the commodity crops, which are the ones that are being traded internationally, those are just everything's in one big pot. It's all mixed together.
Right.
And farmers don't get that advantage for adding value, and they also don't have any control over the price because they are price takers.
The prices are determined on the stock, on the commodity exchange, correct?
Yeah.
The Chicago Mercantile Market?
Is that,
yeah. This stuff is so complex for me that I really have a hard time wrapping my, you know, undereducated brain around it.
I think it's hard for everybody. And it's one reason that people really appreciate local food systems and the ability to interact with farmers. It's an interesting phenomenon that some of the things that are good for the environment, good for farmers, good for public health, are also things that people like, that they enjoy. Having more contact with farmers is great, and choosing products that are better for the environment obviously has environmental benefits. So I think it's one of the reasons this financialization of the whole food system and the way that exchanges of food have become so complex and so distant from the average consumer. People like going to their local co-op or their farmer's market because it's so immediate and so tangible. They can see what they're getting. They can talk to the farmer. They know exactly what's up, or at least they think they do.
You know, the problem is that people, I mean, in this country, I'm going to focus mostly on the United States, A, because, as you mentioned at the top of the program, when your ISTAT report came out in, what was it, 2009 or 2008?
Mm-hmm. It
was basically
2009. It was published.
It was ignored, as was the Plate of the Union initiative that was started by, you know, Ricardo Salvador and Olivier Deschutes and, you know, some of these other big, Mark Bittman, Michael Pollan, you know, that whole initiative, which was supposed to garner support for, you know, even just examining the food system. And it really, I mean, I promoted it as much as I could on the program, and it really, it just went nowhere. Didn't you? I mean, would you agree with that? They were, I was very disappointed that those issues, which I see as highly political, did not somehow make it into public discourse. And I guess my question to people like you is how do we make this, make these arguments compelling enough for people to really start paying attention? I don't understand why there is this deafening silence on the part of, you know, at least the middle class, you know, the people who can go to the farmer's market and do have the money to buy a slightly more expensive product. I mean, I don't understand why there isn't more traction in this movement than there has been. And you've obviously been working in it for a long time. How do you explain that?
Well, it's interesting that you would ask about that because I was just on a call a couple of days ago. I'm part of the narrative, new narrative subgroup of Food Solutions New England. You mentioned that when you were introducing me. And we are very interested in reforming our food system in New England, getting to 50% of the food that we consume in New England being produced in New England. Not literally, but 50% of the value being produced in New England by the year 2060. And we got together and did a very complicated systems mapping exercise, which I thought was a lot of fun. But then I'm a systems ecologist by training. Some people thought it was a little mind-boggling, and they glazed over. But everybody, I think, was happy with the results. And the results said that one of the things that we really have to do to enact this reform is to shift the narrative in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The narrative has become fixated on industrialized agriculture.
Yes.
And there have been massive amounts of money poured into propaganda to support that. Frances Moore LePay, who is one of my heroes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, she has been pushing for this new narrative for ages, really ever since Diet for a Small Planet came out.
Yeah.
And she just rewrote with Joseph Collins the food myths book, World Myths.
Yeah, I interviewed her for that on this program.
Yeah, it's down to 10.
Yeah.
She decided to simplify it a little bit. And these myths that she's fighting against are still very much out there in public discourse. Among the myths is this idea that we're fighting about in EPA's food, that you need industrialized farming to feed the world.
Right.
As if with 15% of the food being internationally traded, that we're actually feeding the world, and with about 800 million people hungry and food insecure by a very conservative estimate by the Food and Agriculture Organization, as if we're feeding the world now. We're producing more than enough, but we're obviously not feeding the world adequately and not feeding it with healthy food. So our question is, how do we shift that narrative? So we are going to a lot of the other organizations that seem to be shifting it successfully. For instance, there's been some progress with climate change. There's been a lot of progress with tobacco in shifting the narrative. Nobody would tell you now, believably, that tobacco is healthy and doctors smoke cigarettes because it's so good for them, which was part of the advertising when, just a few decades ago.
For sure.
You look at some of those old ads and you're just incredulous.
Yes.
How did people buy this stuff?
Yeah.
But it was because of the propaganda that they were being fed relentlessly by the tobacco industry in that case and by the food industry in the current case. And I have to say the U.S. government has not done nearly enough to protect the public from this harmful discourse, to protect us from the kinds of food that we shouldn't be eating, to make sure that healthy food is widely available to everyone in this country at prices that we can afford. It's been very discouraging to see the ways in which the Department of Agriculture has kind of marched side by side
in lockstep
with ag industry.
Yeah, absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, I remember going to a meeting in Washington D.C. when there was an official from one of the food industries who was followed by, who gave his spiel about what sustainable agriculture is all about and how what they're doing is really promoting the health of the public, which is not true. And he was followed by Catherine Motecki from the Department of Agriculture. And her first comments were, it's just amazing how similarly we see the world.
Oof.
But it's not amazing, given the amount of lobbying that's gone on, the amount of campaign donations that
absolutely
have been made by the food industry. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I think in this respect, I'm fairly pragmatic. In other respects, I would say I err on the side of being idealistic when it comes to food policy and the kinds of things that I would like to see happening in this country. I'm definitely an idealist, especially compared to someone like Ferd Hefner, who is about as firmly rooted on the ground as a policy wonk can get. And I hope that you have him on the show at some point.
I've just been seeing his name somehow everywhere, like the Scarlet Pimpernel, and I'm realizing, why haven't I interviewed this person before? So I thank you for suggesting that. And to go back to what you said about lobbying, I noticed, and I wrote this down in my notes, your report mentions that $130 million was spent in lobbying Congress by food companies, and that includes things like Cargill, National Cattlemen's Beef Association, or you know, all of the big grain producers, etc. So that, in case people wanted an actual figure, $130 million right there. That was just for last year, I guess, right?
Imagine what you could do with $130 million.
Yeah, Right. What you could do to help farmers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What you could do,
you know, to help retrofit your farm, to, you know, to provide them better equipment to manage effluent and waste. I mean, that's the other thing that I find, you know, so tragic. I know we're getting off on a tangent here, but just, you know, one of the things that I think of as one of the most unfair aspects of not only how the public views farming, but also how the government abuses farmers. And that is that they, you know, like when you sign up to as I said, I'm a big meat wonk, but it's when you sign up to grow chickens or something like that, you know, you are left with dead birds and a lot of waste material and no assistance from the parent company in managing either of those things. And then people are shocked and horrified when that waste winds up in your water supply or, you know, a lagoon breaks or something like that. I mean, it's just, I think that's criminal myself. I think that farmers are horribly abused in the sense of being given no help with managing some of these major ecological problems that are
attendant. Well, I would agree.
Attendant.
There is a big program, EQIP. It's one of the federal programs that supports farmers, but EQIP gives massive amounts of money to CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations. That's one of the ways that all of this money spent on lobbying has continued to benefit some of the big producers.
Right.
So instead of saying we're going to save this money for good things, for cover crops, for crop rotations,
right,
for small farmers who are doing the best they can but need a little bit of help, say, to put in riparian buffers. There's a new law in Vermont that says that dairy farms need to do a bit more to protect water quality.
Right.
And it's really hurting the dairy farmers here who are already in trouble.
Right.
But EQIP funds can still be used to fund CAFOs, and far too much of that money is going to support these people who are doing the wrong thing from the very beginning. They're not even trying to do the right thing.
Well, I have to say that from the point of view of somebody who is growing chickens for Tyson or something like that, I think that, you know, if you go into that business, I mean, we can argue the rights and wrongs of the business. But the reality is that it's usually just some bloke who thinks he's going to make some money by growing chickens and doesn't realize that 50,000 chickens is going to produce, you know, 150 million pounds of bird shit every year. And what is he supposed to do with that? And that in that case, I would like to see EQIP give those funds to a farmer like that who is basically living from paycheck to paycheck anyway. Those are the people that I think need to be supported. And, you know, you can argue the pros and cons of that style of animal production. But the reality is that those facilities are polluting, you know, regularly. And those people who engage in that business, I think, need help. But I wanted to, because we're going to run out of time, Molly. I wanted to talk about your 8 lock-ins, because that sort of speaks to what we're talking a little bit about, in the sense of like trying to shift the narrative and trying to get people to think of new ways of doing things. So can you like just buzz us through the 8 lock-ins?
Yeah, I can go through them quickly. Some of them are complicated, and I was rereading the report just because I knew that we'd be focusing on it, and I thought, wow, the folks who did the final cut on this, and I'd have to say that I went through it many times. The whole panel contributed to this report. Emile Frison was the primary author, and he deserves a lot of credit, as well as our secretariat, who again went through it just with a fine-tooth comb. But I think it's very readable in explaining how those lock-ins work.
Yeah, I thought so.
The first one, we point to path dependency, the fact that the way that industrialized agriculture is set up is kept in place by policies that incentivize more industrialized agriculture instead of incentivizing a transition to diversified farming systems, which would be for the public good, of course, and for farmers' good. But farmers are caught in this. The whole agricultural industry, in a sense, is caught in this vicious circle, with a few players benefiting disproportionately from it.
Right.
The very large companies that are becoming even larger now with mega mergers that are happening.
Right.
But that path dependency keeps a lot of things in place, just like a farmer who starts growing corn and soy gets locked into corn and soy because he's invested in really expensive machinery and
right.
infrastructure to deal with corn and soy, and that's what he knows to do.
Yeah.
So it's not really the farmer's fault, it's the system's fault, which is not to say that there's nobody responsible for fixing the system. I would point to our government, first of all, but we can't point to individual farmers and say, hey, you're making bad decisions here.
Right.
The second issue is export orientation. We talked about that a little bit
yep.
already, that far too much of our policy, our subsidies, are going into these commodity crops that are being exported, largely for animal feed,
yes.
to some extent for ethanol. But we're focusing on exports instead of focusing on local markets for the things that people actually eat, vegetables, which we should be eating a whole lot more of,
right.
Local foods that would give farmers a little bit more of a decent income. The third lock-in is the expectation that we have developed in this country over the last few decades of having very cheap food,
yep.
of paying only about 11% of our income on average for food. Of course, people who are low income pay much more than that as a percentage of their budget. And people who are getting the maximum allocation from SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Action Program, they cannot afford a healthy diet as is recommended by USDA. But by and large, we expect to get really cheap food, and our government is providing that with the understanding that this is something that benefits people in urban areas. There's been kind of an urban bias in food policy for a long time. Having cheap food certainly doesn't benefit farmers. Farmers,
right?
I mentioned the dairy farmers in Vermont a few minutes ago. Their costs of production are higher than the prices they're getting for milk now.
Yes.
So it's no surprise that they are going out of business right and left.
Yeah.
You might be able to hang on for a year or so, but you're definitely not going to hang on for long, and you're definitely not going to be encouraging your kids to go into farming with those kinds of prices.
That's right.
But the public wants this and would be very angry if we didn't have it. I'd have to say that cheap food, having cheap food available, is also benefiting employers who don't have to pay living wages, who can get away with not paying living wages. If we had people literally starving in our country because they couldn't afford to buy food, and there are some people who can't afford to buy food at all, or who can't afford, many, many more people who can't afford to buy healthy food, there is hunger in this country.
There is. I mean,
if,
40
if
million
we,
food insecure households. That's a USDA figure.
About 14% of our households, 12.7.
40 million
by
people.
By the latest figures.
Unbelievable.
It really is.
This is unknown,
country,
by the way.
If this was obvious to people, if people were literally starving on the streets, then it would be intolerable to the American public. The juxtaposition of very wealthy and just absolutely destitute would be awful. Of course, that juxtaposition is happening internationally. I just read that the latest report from Oxfam International says that 8 people in the world now have the same wealth, the same assets, as the lowest 50% of the population. So inequality is rising. The expectation of cheap food allows us to continue with that inequality in this country. The next lock-in is compartmentalized thinking, where we aren't thinking about the whole food system. We're thinking about one thing at a time.
Yeah.
For instance, we think about increasing productivity, and that's been such a monomania of our research institutions for so long that if you just increase yields and productivity, then everything will be fine. But while we've been increasing yields and productivity, the environment has gone to hell. We've seen greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture grow to around 29%. That's the upper range of a report in 2012. Some people say it's even higher when you include everything. We've seen wages for farm workers locked in at stagnant levels.
Yes.
Haven't grown in decades. It's really shameful. And we've seen a public health crisis with
yes.
obesity and all of the diseases, including many of the top killers in the United States, which are linked to obesity. We've seen that increasing at exponential rates.
Yeah.
So it's that compartmentalized thinking that says, well, yeah, we can tackle obesity with
exercise programs,
stomach staples, or exercise. Yeah,
right.
and that'll take care of the problem. Instead
right.
of saying it's a problem that is really permeating our entire food system.
Yeah.
The next lock in is, and tell me if I need to go faster on these, but the next one is short term thinking, which is really driven by political cycles. Of politicians who want to be reelected
yeah.
and are not thinking about the future, who are thinking about whatever will bring short-term benefits to their own districts. Wendell Berry and Wes Jackson had a really good op-ed in the New York Times, I think it must have been over a year ago, on a 50-year farm bill, the things
yeah.
that we should be looking at in the farm bill. And they focused on soil loss.
Yes.
Because we are losing
or soil health.
Topsoil.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's one of our most incredible assets and one of the things that has made the Midwest so amazingly productive with all of these products that have been poured on to increase productivity even more. But it won't remain productive with that level of soil loss. And I think the latest figure shows something like 20% of soil globally is degraded.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be focusing on the basic resources that are needed.
Yeah.
Soil, fresh water, the people and the skills that they need to grow food sustainably and
mm-hmm.
to do so in a way that will bring them back decent livelihoods. We need to be thinking about that. But
yeah.
what politician is going to get reelected on a platform of, let's stop soil erosion? it's not going anywhere.
That's right. I wish we could go on and on and on, Molly. It only says that we have to have you back in really literally in a few weeks. Like I'm booking for February, March now. And I hope you'll come back because I want to talk about the final section of the report and we don't have time for it today. But you have seven recommendations. Yeah. And I want to talk about the positive. I want to talk about like, okay, now we've laid out what the problems are. You know, let's start thinking about positive solutions, about re-regionalizing agriculture and distribution, about
mm-hmm.
working on labor issues, you know, all of the stuff that I know that, you know, if the people of this country think about it for 5 minutes, they'll want to do it. And, you know, just take it all back from this ghastly incoming administration. You and I will have to exchange phone numbers. Well, I have your phone number now and I will send you mine so that we can connect at the Women's March because you are coming down from Vermont to do that, right?
Yes,
you're going
I
to the
am.
One in D.C., right?
I absolutely have to be there. And I'm bringing my daughter, too.
Good for you.
Who is hugely concerned about Trump's record on women and reproductive rights.
I mean, any the fact that he has no ag secretary pick means that he's literally completely in the dark about food policy and agriculture.
It's dismal.
One of the things that I plan to do, because I'm going down a few, I'm driving myself, so I don't want to get caught in traffic. I am going to spend at least one of the days that I'm in D.C. going from office to office in the House of Representatives and in the Senate to complain and demand that they pay attention to things like food policy.
That's great.
I know. I think a lot of us should do that. If you're going to go down there for a few days, maybe you'll join me.
Well, I've got to be back up here on Monday.
Yeah, I'm going to go Wednesday.
We're in the middle of a teaching term, and I've got students. But
right.
I would love to stay down, and I need to get down more often and show my face in
we need you, Molly. We need
halls.
Your voice. That's right. We need your voice more than anything else. So thank you so much for joining me on the show. I will send you a note to make another date. And thanks so much to my sponsor today, New York Organic Grown and Certified. Did I say that right, Dave? No. That's me all over. Just can't get I usually try to write that down. But anyway, they know what I'm giving them the love.
New York State Grown and Certified.
New York State Grown and Certified. Thank you, Dave. And Molly, thank you so much. And we'll see you next week for another great show about food policy and politics. Thanks for listening, folks. Have a good week.
Thank you, Katie.
My pleasure, Molly.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.